A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
This is the BBC.
Hiya, thanks for downloading the show. My name is Susan Kalman. I'm a comedian and this is my podcast, Mrs. Brightside, a cheerful take on depression. Today I'm talking to Bethany Black.
I remember growing up and the only sort of representation of mental health of any kind was Howling Mad Murdoch off of The A-Team.
Oh yeah.
Which massively oversold the benefits and how much fun it would be.
You had a lot of fun.
I've never stolen and flown a plane and that is one of my great regrets.
I've known Bethany a very long time. We started out in comedy about the same time, and she has a fascinating life, a fascinating story, a fascinating journey in comedy as well. And I couldn't wait to talk to her just one-on-one about her life, about mental health, about anxiety, because she's one of the strongest women I've ever met, and it turned out she's even stronger than I thought she was. I like this bit, which is the bit where I tell you we're about to go. Don't speak yet, Beth.
Sorry. Okay,
it's testament to how well my career is going that I'm sitting on a warm spring day in a basement in Soho talking about mental health issues. In this episode, I'm joined by Bethany Black.
Hello.
Yes, you're allowed to speak to Bethany.
Oh, I can speak now. Yeah, right, speak okay, now. Cool.
Bethany, would you like to introduce yourself to the people listening?
Hello, I'm Bethany Black, and I don't know. Like, it's always what do you need to know about me?
Well, what would you like to say?
I'm like properly mental. I know that much. Which is a good.
Usually, people start with their career, but straight in with that.
Yeah, well, my career has basically been me attempting to monetize my mental illness. That's been the big chunk of it.
Right.
I'm a comedian. I've accidentally ended up with an acting career. Never intended to do that.
Yeah.
And I've been a comedian for about 15 years now.
We started probably about the same time,
didn't
we?
We did, yeah. I think we started, it was roughly around about the same. You, me and Sarah Millican all started around about the same
time.
Yeah, I know.
Whatever happened to her?
I know. Where's she on a day like this? Not in a basement in Soho, I'll tell you that.
She's sitting in her house going, not doing that.
Not doing that. and I'm looking at both of you going, I wish I'd worked
harder.
For
the record, Sarah Millican would have done this if she was available. I'm sure she would have.
Yeah.
So this podcast, there aren't actually any parameters about what we're talking about. I just think talking about depression, mental health, whatever you want, anxiety, in any way is a positive thing.
Yeah.
Because hopefully there'll be less shame about it, less stigma about it. And do you know what? It's actually quite good fun.
Yeah, it is.
Two depressed people having a chat is actually quite funny.
It is, yeah. Because I think a lot of when you're laughing, it's that moment of forgetting that you have. It's the moment of forgetting any existential crisis that you may have. Mm-hmm. And so I think, like, chatting about it, it does make it easier. It does make it easier to talk about because, like, I remember growing up and the only sort of representation of mental health of any kind, poor or good, was Howling Mad Murdoch off of The A-Team.
Oh, yeah.
Which massively oversold the benefits and how much fun it would be.
Yeah, he had a lot of fun.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. He did. He had loads of fun. Like, he got to fly planes regularly. He got to knock out Mr. T. He did all of these things.
Which is not the reality of being a depressed person in the United Kingdom in 2018.
No, it's not.
No.
I've never stolen and flown a plane. And that is one of my great regrets.
Why not?
I know.
So let's start from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Very good place to start.
Yeah, of course.
I have been depressed as long as I can remember, right? Just lucky like that.
Yeah.
My anxiety and depression has changed throughout the years, but essentially I don't ever really remember being huge, not happy, but there's always been something niggling away that's made me sadder than other children, for example.
Yeah.
When were you aware of the fact that you were sadder than perhaps others were?
It must have been from very young. Like, it must have been about 6 or 7 when I like really started to go, oh, right, life is terrible. and I'm just, I don't fit into this world and nothing is ever going to be right about it. And the fear, it was a lot of it came from fear, I think, initially. A lot of it was just like, okay, because if I tell anybody, because I'm supposed to be happy, you're a kid, you're supposed to be happy. What have you got to be worried about?
My favourite thing.
Yeah.
Hey, what have you got to be sad about?
Well,
everything's fine.
Yeah, everything's great. Yeah. Isn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Apart from that massive weight that's crushing my chest and the inability to breathe.
Yeah.
When I'm in the middle of a party where everyone else is having an absolutely fantastic time and I feel more lonely than I could ever imagine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember feeling quite young because I'm trans, right? Which people may or may not know about me, and that always confuses people as well because I'm also a lesbian, which people always go, oh, so you were born a man, which is rubbish. No one was baby. That's the usual size and age to be born. And so the way I always see it is that it's like a bit of admin that needed sorting out.
Right.
That when I was born, they got this one, they went and made an assumption based on an incomplete set of data. And based on that, a load of other things that then happened in my life happened that probably shouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. And as a result, I've had to deal with that and spend a lot of time trying to sort all of the admin related to that out. Mm-hmm. So there's no sort of like, you know, because people have this idea when you talk about growing up trans of like, oh, no, there you are, a little boy getting on with it. And suddenly, oh, you found lipstick and makeup and went, oh, I think I want to be a girl. And it's not that at all. It's this massive sense of not quite, not just not fitting in with the world, but also not fitting in my own skin.
Mm-hmm.
Just something about me wasn't right. And the way that I related to myself. And the way that I related to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And not as some people seem to think, you know, gender is all about gender roles and, you know, and reinforcing stereotypes and stuff like that. There's none of that that's sort of going on. Anyone who's met me in the flesh knows that.
One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you specifically,
yeah,
apart from the fact I know you,
yeah, yeah,
is there's a very interesting thing of, if you look back on newsreels about lesbians,
yeah,
25 years ago, it's astonishing what's said about us.
Yeah, yeah.
And in a way, there is a fashion for talking about trans at the moment. And I get frustrated because I never hear anyone who's actually in that situation talk.
Yeah.
You hear panels of people talking about what it is. It's the same as when you hear a discussion about breast cancer in women and the effect, and there's not a single woman asked to speak about what it's like to have breast cancer as a woman.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that all of these things, it makes me angry that for some reason they don't actually ask the people who've been through it.
No, they don't. And what they try and do is, I don't know, it's almost like this illusion of balance that a lot of people have this thing, well, what you need to do is you need to get some people who are pro and some people who are anti, but if you're too close to it, then you can't be an unbiased voice. So let's go and get these people who are discussing whether or not these people have the right to exist. And we'll call that balance. And it's like that, it isn't. It's a difficult thing to sort of, it's not a difficult thing to talk about, really. It's, you don't get involved and you don't get included as much. And also because a lot of the time, especially in the newspapers, and this goes right across the political spectrum from the far left to the far right, like right the way across, there are people all through there who all have this idea that trans issues and transgender people and trans people are somehow a thought exercise and that they're not talking about actual living, breathing people who exist. It's like like they're talking about some sort of theoretical tribe that lives off in the wild jungles of an uncharted island that no one's ever seen, and how they might interact if they were to be allowed to deal with normal people.
It's the same way I felt when people were talking about equal marriage.
Yeah.
A bunch of people sat and discussed whether I had the right to get married.
Yeah.
Me, a human being on this planet, you're talking about whether or not I have the right. And I don't think they equated it to actual people,
They don't.
So when you hear a discussion of a group of people, it just makes me very nervous.
Yeah, because I think you need to include people when you're talking about them. I think that's the thing. If you're talking about a group, I mean, it's in 2003 the Gender Recognition Act came through. I think it was enforced in 2004, which meant that if you were trans, you could apply to have your birth certificate updated with the correct information, and ever since then you've been able to do that. And one of the caveats that they made with that was that in order to do that, you had to get two doctor's notes, one from a psychiatrist, one from your doctor. You then had to... There's a fee that you need to do because you needed to get a letter from a solicitor, which I think costs about £1,000 to get sorted out. And then it had to go in front of a panel of cisgender people who would have a look through all of your medical information and the letters that have been sent and decide whether or not you were trans enough to be considered trans. And then if they did decide that, they never met you, they never looked at you, they just looked at the paperwork. And if they decided that you were real and that you weren't messing about and weren't trying to
having
do this.
A laugh.
Yeah, yeah, for the laugh, just, you know, to try and get into changing rooms or whatever it is that the people think. Just to try and get into toilets.
That's my favourite thing. What if you turned around and next to you was a man pretending to be a woman? And the reason it makes me laugh is that's what they used to say about gay people.
Yeah, it is.
That's
yeah, yeah.
the thing. In terms of the prejudice that there is about in society, it seems to have moved on to this entire... Remember, you were probably older than you. Leaflets put through the door. All gay people are paedophiles.
Yes.
All gay people are blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's the same scare tactics.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. It absolutely is.
And one of the things is, you know that loneliness you were talking about? I mean, I loneliness is one of the most horrific feelings in the entire world.
Yeah.
And when I was growing up, no internet.
Mm.
Good days.
Yeah, same.
No internet. Glasgow was okay, but, you know, not fabulous for the gays in the late 80s. Yeah. And I just felt lonely.
Yeah.
And so much of that isolation has informed my depression in later life of that loneliness. And one of the reasons why I think it's important to talk about both of our experiences is I know that somewhere out there is a lonely little kid.
Yeah.
Wanting to find information or just know there's someone else out there like them.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember being... I remember because I grew up in the countryside. Like I grew up in a tiny village of less than 200 people in the northwest of England in the 1980s, and I had never felt so like I just felt like I was the only person in the world who felt like I did. And I remember, and any time that I would see anything that was on in any media, like on TV or in the news or anything like that, I would latch onto that. And for years, the only representation that you got of trans people were sort of Jerry Springer show type reveals that someone was trans and had been secretly tricking someone in order to make them go out with them. And that just felt like, because I didn't relate to that and I couldn't like... get some sort. I couldn't really find any way to sort of latch onto that as anything that was relevant to my life. And the first thing that sort of changed that in any way was when Julie Hesman-Halsh was playing Hayley on Coronation Street, which was just like, which, you know, you look at it now and you go, right, okay, like how that was such a big thing. And the thing that really struck me about that, the thing that I remembered so much about that was in a couple of weeks after the reveal had come about of her character being trans, there was someone had written a letter to the Radio Times about how great it was to suddenly have this transgender character who wasn't sort of all glamorous, it was just someone who's trying to get on with their life, who was just trying to, you know, go about their day-to-day activity. And I remember reading that and for the first time felt like I wasn't on my own in the world. And bizarrely, like 20 years later, met the person who wrote that letter, because it's Annie Wallace, who's now in Hollyoaks, and we're great friends. And it seems just so odd that, you know, someone who was, she was off in Lanarkshire writing this, writing this letter to the Radio Times, and that me in a little, me this sort of like 14, 15 year old in Lancashire, in the middle of nowhere, was able to sort of have this connection to a larger world that actually meant something, that made me go, yeah, I'm not on my own, was just, it meant the world to me. And I think the other thing is, because of the representations that I've seen, both growing up and as an adult, it kind of puts me off whenever anything goes, oh, there's a transgender character in this, because I go, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, is it going to be awful? Is it going to be really cliched? Is it going to make me feel awful for days?
Well, it's even worse afterwards, the lesbian aspect, because we're always psychopaths, serial killers, or we die in, after we find love.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
We find love and die, or we kill everyone else who finds love.
Yeah, yeah, because we can't be happy for anyone else.
A lesbian character who obsesses about recycling. Do you know what I mean?
There's never a lesbian character who obsesses about their pets, which seems far more realistic to me.
That's the thing about that. Do you remember Lip Service on BBC Three, which was incredibly glamorous women living in Glasgow? Yeah. Number one, none of those women lived in Glasgow. Yeah. I would have found them.
Yeah.
Number two, no lesbians lived in houses like that.
Yeah.
Number three, no one had a cat. That is a factual fallacy.
Yeah, yeah.
Factual fallacy. And number four, none of them ever did any recycling.
I mean, where do they think cats come from?
Lesbians.
Yeah,
that's
obviously.
Where they come from. Everyone knows that. Yes.
Yeah, lesbians, we rub belly buttons and then 3 months later a kitten appears.
Yeah, if you're listening thinking, what do lesbians do in bed? Yeah. We make cats.
That's what happens.
Cats. Yeah. So I liked comedy.
Did you?
I did.
Oh, good.
I no longer do.
Yeah, no.
Full of weirdos and freaks talking about weird stuff.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
I struggle with freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be honest with you. I think you can say what you like as long as you stand at the end of the bar at the end of the evening and let someone say something to you.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to sound wishy-washy and snowflakey here. I stopped wanting to do circuit gigs.
Yeah.
Because I was a compere, as you know. Yeah. So I was the one that had to go out and go, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome on stage your first acting.
Yeah.
And then at the end, you have to go, That was amazing, wasn't it? That was blah, blah, blah. And I did a Saturday night or a Sunday night where it was awful.
Mm.
It was misogynistic. It was homophobic. It was just some of the racist stuff I've seen. And I said, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
And Jeremy Hardy, interestingly, said to me, just go and do your own shows.
Yeah.
And surely it's better if three people come and see you who want to hear you than you perform in front of 300 people who laugh at some of the worst jokes. I mean, just horrific jokes.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I remember you at the Fringe, Underbelly, probably?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Best show title in the world,
mm-hmm.
Beth Becomes Her.
Yeah.
Still, singular, the best show title ever at the Fringe.
And it also, for a pun title, fitted the nature of the
show.
Which
is odd, because usually we just go, the Calman before the storm. Doesn't make any sense. Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, Crystal Beth. You know, it's, we do these cut these show titles in January before we've written a word of the show.
Yeah, you don't know what
often.
The show is.
Yeah, yeah. And you've had to write 60 words about what the show is. It's like that thing of, during the holidays, I went to, and you do that, and then you go,
If you're a comedy fan and you wonder why at The Fringe so many comedians have pun show titles, it's because we don't know what the show is.
Yeah.
And therefore, we simply write anything.
Yeah, yeah. I was considering calling my show this year An Hour.
But then it's probably only 55 minutes. It's
Exactly. People are going to get upset.
I started to love comedy properly when I started doing those shows.
Yeah.
And stopped trying to do 15 minutes of jokes. I'm not great at it. You've seen me, Beth. I'm not great at jokes. I'm not. I'm not great. I like to ramble. No, I like to ramble about stuff. After a few tries, 2013, started to love it.
Yeah.
Because I really like that ability to have 55 minutes with an audience to tell them what I want to tell them.
Yeah.
And I, from what I think is that when you started doing that with those shows, it seemed to me that you found your comedy.
I did. And, well, because my first show was an hour-long story of me coming out, really, because I'd never talked about being trans on stage before I did that show. And I told the whole story of that. I told the whole story of the transition of my parents' reaction, my family's reaction, all the way through everything that went on. And that really sort of hit home and unfortunately was about 10 years too early for it to be cool.
I often think if you did that show now with title, it would be completely different.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah. If I'd have done that show in 2016.
Yeah.
Then it, you know, I probably would have, it would have gone on to, you know, being taken off all over the world and doing all those sorts of things. Unfortunately, in 2016, I did an entirely different show, which was very lovely and went really well. And that for me was my feeling of going in and going, right, okay, this is what I want to do. Because I decided I wanted to get off the circuit.
Yeah.
Not for any other reason than, it was, as you said, you know, the amount of times when you have to be on a stage, when you have to share a stage with someone who's just gone on and made an entire room full of people laugh at stuff that's deliberately hurtful to you and people like you. And you have to not acknowledge that at all backstage and just go on and do what you can in front of an audience.
Mm-hmm.
To show that it hasn't affected you in any way. And the thing about that is it makes you dislike the people in the audience.
Oh, absolutely.
Because you're like, I want to like you. And also I have a pathological need to be liked by people. So it's like,
that's why I'm here. I need you to love me.
Yeah, I want you to love me and I want to love you as well. But right now I'm angry with you. I'm angry with you for not seeing through the trick that they just put. I mean, because, you know, as a comedian, the other thing is that every time you go on stage, the first 30 or 40 seconds, I'm thinking, is this going to be the night? Is this going to be the point when somebody sort of emperor's new clothes me and stands up and goes, hang on a second, you're not actually funny. You're just saying things in an order and making people laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Like that isn't just all it is.
Yes.
And everyone go, oh, yeah, no, you are. That's absolutely right. You need to. You're no good at this. But yeah, doing hour long shows. That really sort of made me go, right, okay, I can do this. And then I went back the next year and did another show that I probably shouldn't have done. Like, I started doing a show about how, like, me following my heart gets me into trouble.
Was that Love Enough Cult 45?
Yeah, it was.
And about that one as well.
Yeah, and about 2 months before I went to the Fringe, I realised that I had a massive drug and alcohol problem.
Well, wasn't that an inconvenient time to realise that?
Yeah, it was. And so I suddenly had to like rewrite the entire show whilst trying to get sober, whilst also being completely insane. And so I tried to do the show, which was also quite a heartfelt and personal show about discovering things that you have these conditions that you had just assumed were perfectly normal, that you did things in the exact same way that everyone else did. And then having to try and do that every night for a month at 11:05 at the Underbelly to crowds of people who couldn't get into the late night show Spank. Who was wholly unsuited for such.
It was late at night. I remember it was late at night.
Yeah, it was like 11:05.
Yeah. It was. I would say too late.
Yeah, it was far too late for a show of that type. And so I played to like 10 people a night for a month.
What's been quite interesting though, so I knew you then,
mm-hmm.
festival shows, circuit gigs, which mm-hmm. I stopped doing. Sorry, I haven't seen you.
No, that's fine.
Then you did something which was very beautiful, which was, I always get confused.
Banana.
Mm-hmm. Which was part of the Cucumber
Trilogy.
So there was the Russell T.
Yeah.
Davis show. And then there was kind of offshoots of it. There was Cucumber. And I watched it and I thought it was incredible.
Thank you.
Your show was incredible. And you were playing in that show a trans character.
Yes. I was the first trans person to play a trans character in a leading role on British television. And because of the way that it was already had a distribution deal for the US, and because it was on network television, I was the first trans person to play a trans character on US network television.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Whatever. So, then you were in Doctor Who.
And then I was in Doctor Who.
I don't even want to talk to you about that. I don't.
Yeah, no.
Because I quite like you, and that makes me hate you.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it makes me hate me. Do you know what the amount
you've been
of
Doctor Who?
Yeah, the amount of people when the amount of people who I it surprised me because it was that I've been a Doctor Who fan. First television memory was Four to Doomsday, Peter Davison, and just been a Doctor Who fan for all of that time. Big Russell T Davies fan, and to then get cast in it, I was, you know, that it's going to be the best thing that you're ever going to do and nothing's ever going to compare to it again. So it's, you know, my life has been downhill since then.
Yeah, lovely to talk to you about Doctor Who, Beth. Let's
and can
move
only
on.
Be downhill.
It's all I ever want. Here's a question.
Yeah.
Both of us, this is no disrespect to either of us, had good careers.
Yeah.
Stoughton along, quite happy. But we could quite happily leave our houses without anybody going, that's that comedian. Yeah. But through a combination of what I've done and what you've done, people will recognise you now.
Yeah.
Now, I find it quite interesting for someone with, if I'm feeling bad, if I'm having a bad day and I still have to go out, I know I have to smile. I know I have to be nice to people. And in a way, it makes it more complicated when you're having a bad time.
Yeah.
Do you feel that now when you go out as a more pressure affects you more?
It doesn't, it doesn't. It does in certain ways. Because one of the great things is because of Doctor Who, the thing that I did in Doctor Who, which is the thing that people recognise me for, I had a big full face tattoo. So a lot of people don't recognise me from that. I've been stood next. Like I will occasionally go into comic book shops and just stand next to things with my face on it just to see if anyone recognises me. And it's 50-50 whether or not they will do. But people do. And it's that thing of recognising when... It suddenly makes going outside of the house part of your job. That's what it does. It makes going outside.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Become a part of the job. Like it used to be, my job was driving to a place and then being on stage and then driving home again. And now... It also includes people coming up to me and wanting to ask me questions when I've just had a fight with my partner in the supermarket.
That's it. I had a fight with my wife the other day and I was crying and we were going to the gym and I had to stop crying because I couldn't cry because then that lady off Strictly would have been having a fight with her wife.
Yeah.
And it was really annoying because she was, my wife was being totally wrong about everything and I wanted to just shout at her.
Yeah.
Sharply, you're being stupid.
Yeah.
It was my fault. Yeah. But you have to stop. You can't do it.
As my partner Sana always says, I don't know why you're getting angry at me, you're just making this relationship harder on yourself.
Yeah. When it comes to my anxiety and depression, I found talking about it helped, I found CBT helped.
Yeah.
Have you ever gone to therapy?
Yes, I have. I'm currently on a waiting list to get psychotherapy because it turns out that I have PTSD.
Right.
Which a lot of it comes from getting attacked quite a lot as a teenager. And as a result of that, I find it really difficult. I don't get on public transport. I can't get buses. I can't get trains. I can't get tubes. I have to drive somewhere and then walk the rest of it. But I also panic about being outside quite a lot. So a lot of the time I end up wearing headphones and sunglasses when I'm out. And it's just, it's a thing to just sort of like try and bring the world into something that I can control, because that feeling of loss of control and having other people, you know, being able to being able to just ruin your day with a single comment or even a single look sometimes. Just like, okay, everything's gone wrong. Like on the way walking today, I parked up and then started walking down and was like, right, okay, I'm panicking. I'm late. I'm in London. I don't know where I am. Right, I've got to get there. I've got to do this. And I was walking and I had my sunglasses on. I had my headphones on. I was listening to Albatross by Fleetwood Mac on repeat. And suddenly, as a group of teenagers walking towards me, so my heart rate races, and I suddenly went over on my ankle, and it was just that thing of like, of course I did at that point because I was panicking, and I saw this group of teenagers walking towards me, which always terrifies me because it just takes me back to being a teenager and having gangs of teenagers be horrible to me, and it was just. It was just that thing of like falling over and them laughing and me feeling so awful about it. And it's that thing that people don't get. Like, I've been trying to think a lot about this, and I've realised that I sort of, partly I became a comedian because I love comedy, and because when I was growing up, that was a thing that I could really connect with my dad with and my brother. And the other part of it is because I have an innate distrust of laughter. I don't like it when people laugh at me, and I don't know why it is that they're laughing. And I don't like it, especially when I do know why it is that they're laughing, and it's something that I didn't do on purpose.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Because I hate people laughing at me.
Mm.
Like, hate it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I like people laughing at me if I've told them a joke.
Yes.
And I've given them permission to laugh at me.
Yeah.
But it comes again from, I think, from when I was younger and people laughing at me.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I would try and wear the right dresses at the school disco, but I never looked right.
Yeah.
And people would laugh at me.
Yeah, it's...
It's all... It sounds really, really stereotypical, but for me, it genuinely is pretty much all from my childhood.
Yeah.
My lack of self-confidence.
Yeah.
And those flashbacks to not feeling like a cool kid, like at the fringe. I never feel like a cool kid at the fringe.
I don't either. And I... And, yeah, and... Last time was great because I was stopping with my pal Trish, who lives in Loch End, and lovely. She has nothing to do with the fringe whatsoever, so it's just me and her in her flat for a month. And I was home before midnight, apart from the one night that I was doing late and live, and then I was in the loft bar for about 20 minutes and then went, nah, this isn't for me. This is not for me anymore. And it was that thing of, like, because I used to drink and do drugs, and I that was like a social lubricant. That was a way for me, partly that was a way for me to, it was partly a way for me to get over the crippling lack of self-confidence that I had, and being able to do that and stay out all night and hang out with people and feel like I could be part of the cool kids. But never, I realised very young that I was never going to be one of the cool kids. I remember being at primary school and going, right, okay, I'm not one of the cool kids, but what I can do is I can make the kids that have charisma that everyone likes, I can become their best friend by making them laugh. And if I can do that, then I can kind of protect myself throughout school. And that's pretty much, that was a survival instinct. That's what I did. And so... Looking back at becoming a comedian and that, it just seems obvious that that's what I would do.
How personal do you get in your shows?
Oh, ridiculously personal. I tell, like, I remember for Beth Becomes It, there's a story I told about the suicide attempt that went wrong. And that came back because I was, I'd met someone and I was chatting them up, and like we got chatting and bizarre, we ended up getting really, really getting on all day, and it was back and forth and back and forth. We ended up just sharing some really personal experiences, and I told her that story for the first time that I'd ever told anyone. And the pair of us just sort of sat there laughing about this failed suicide attempt. And I went over to see my friend afterwards, went over to his house to sort of like, you know, decompress and debrief. And we sat there smoking and drinking cups of tea and chatting about stuff. And I mentioned this and got to the end of the story. And my friend, the comedian, Michael J. Dolan, was sat there and said, do you talk about that on stage? And I went, no. And he went, you should, because that's where the comedy is. That's find a thing you wouldn't tell anyone else. Find that thing that you think you're the only person that thinks and that you wouldn't tell anyone else, and share it with a group of strangers. and that's where you'll find the art in what you're doing. And he was absolutely right, and that's what I've tried to do ever since then. That's why all of the shows that I've written, I mean, my club set stand-up touches on that a little bit. I talk about OCD because I discovered I had OCD. It's one of these weird things. Like, I always thought I was a hypochondriac, and it turns out I'm not. I've actually just got a lot of things wrong with me. Like, genuinely. And it's bizarre. It's like, do you know what? I'm probably... Because that's part of my mental illness, going, no, you're just putting this on. You just want other people to think that you're something special because, yeah, like, as if that makes me a cool kid. Like, having all of these problems.
You've got a lot of initials. PTSD, OCD.
Yeah, OCD. Yeah,
not bad.
I can't... Yeah, and so it was like... the way that I found out about it as well, because it doesn't present itself in the way that, you know, that OCD does on television and in films. It's lovely and visual when it's done that way.
And straightening people, up mirrors. And
yeah,
like
people
that.
Have all of those things. And my house is awful. Like, like, my car is even worse.
You can't have OCD. Your house is a mess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. My car was so filthy that it once got broken into and the police thought it had been stolen and abandoned. Like, they genuinely thought that someone had abandoned it in a back street in Manchester and emptied a bin in the back seat. And I had to act like that was a surprise when I went to get it back.
What have they done? What? It's usually so lovely.
Yeah, it's so perfect. And yeah, and because it turns out that it, because I've always had intrusive thoughts, and I've always had those thought processes where my brain is telling me to do horrible things that I really don't want to do, and has made me go, well, you're an awful person because you keep thinking this. Like, I've never been able to hold a newborn baby because my brain always just goes, drop it, drop it, drop it, drop it, drop it, kick it under the couch. And it's just horrible stuff like that.
Yeah.
And like, I'll get home from a gig and be convinced that even though it's gone perfectly well, that what's happened is I've been on stage and just said nothing but racial slurs for a full 20 minutes and then told everyone in the green room that I hate them all and then threatened the promoter and then jumped in the car and hit someone on my way home, and that I'm just trying to convince myself that I haven't done that. And it's horrible. So, like, because I ended up going to the doctors about, because I got dry skin on my hands and was wondering what it was, and was like, I don't know why this is happening. And she asked me a bunch of questions, and one of them was like, well, how many times a day do you wash your hands? And I went, I don't know. I think I sort of counted it and went, it must be about 30 or 40 times a day. And she went, yeah, that is quite excessive. Like, on stage, I say it's like 80 or 90, because 30 or 40 doesn't...
It's not quite enough, is it?
Not quite enough for a joke.
Quite enough.
It's not quite enough for it to be funny, is it?
Nope.
It's
not that, audience, we exaggerate anything for your comedic pleasure. Ever.
Yeah, all of these things are 100%
absolutely
true.
You can
accurate.
Trust us when we're on stage.
Yeah, completely. You can trust us when we're on stage. Like, other than that, that is the only thing I've ever told a lie about. And my partner's not a nurse. But other than that...
Other than that, everything Beth has ever said is absolutely true. Yes.
A lot of it is true. Yeah, and she asked me a bunch of other questions. So I ended up... Like, because I was having a lot of difficulty. I discovered that I had anxiety. Because... When you've got something massive in your life that's weighing you down, that's like, because I, at the age of 18, age of 20, I tried to kill myself a bunch of times because I just couldn't face up to the idea of what being trans meant. Because everything that I'd ever seen suggested that I would lose my friends and my family, and that no one would want to have anything to do with me, and that, you know, I'd have to go and start again somewhere else. And so a big chunk of my teenage years was me attempting to make the people who I loved and cared about hate me, in an attempt to make sure that they wouldn't care when I disappeared or died. Mm-hmm. And I eventually reached the point where it was, where it had got so bad that I was just trying to kill myself, like, on a regularly... every couple of days. And after about 2 months of this and 2 months of just being like, I wasn't there anymore. I was completely dissociated. I was watching my life happen as if I was a third person in it. I went to my doctor, and this is how much of a liar mental illness is to you. Mm-hmm. I went to my doctor and went, you should probably try and convince them that you're depressed. because you might be able to get some drugs out of this. And obviously, you're not depressed.
Christ, no.
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 Obviously, what you're doing is you're trying to get attention. So what you should do is go to them and tell them that I was self-harming. I was doing all sorts of stuff. I was in such a state. And they sent, like, they immediately went and sent a social worker and a psychiatrist round to see me at home, like, 2 days later, which I found out later was because that takes two people if they want to section you under the Mental Health Act. And I was sat in my lounge chatting to them, and they said, why do you think you feel like this? And I can remember everything about the lounge. I can remember everything I was wearing, just sitting there and looking at the floor and thinking, this is it. You have a choice right now. You can tell them. You can tell them that you're trans, or you can lie and end up in a psychiatric hospital. Because they are, it's clear that
they
were
at that point, had you told anyone?
I'd occasionally when I'd got drunk. It was one of those things, I got really drunk and I'd tell people, and then the next day go, God, I don't know what I was saying that for.
Right. So you were at that point, though, isolated, alone,
yeah,
considering the implications of saying what is, and back then even more so, I have to say, a huge thing.
Yeah.
No wonder you were feeling like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And being able to look at it from this time, you know, which, but you know, I'm only in it to try and get into women's toilets. yeah.
Guys, you know. If I have to try and kill myself a few times and live life with 20 years of anxiety, yeah, so I can get in a lady's toilet,
totally,
you are
worth
playing
it.
The long fucking game, that Beth.
It is a long game.
You have invested in this.
I've certainly put the hours in.
You put the hours in to be a sexual predator in a, yeah, lady's toilet.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'd let you do it just because I think you've earned the right.
I think I have after that. After all of the time, money and effort that I've put into this. And do you know what? And I still have yet to, like, I still think statistically, you are less likely to be assaulted in a toilet by a trans person than a member of Girls Aloud. I honestly think that is, I think that's just maths,
yes,
isn't it?
And I mean, yes, yes. I find it, do you know what? It's a really, isolation and loneliness to me, and fear of, yeah, being honest. We seem fearless,
yeah,
on stage.
We've
not always been fearless,
no,
and we are still not fearless. I still have fears about talking about how I feel.
Oh God, yeah.
About things.
Yeah.
And things are often, bring stuff back up, and it's a constant battle.
Yeah. I still find it difficult to talk about being trans on stage, especially sort of club set type stuff. I find it a lot easier in shows where I know that people have come to see me, but like if I'm in any sort of comedy club, I find it difficult to talk about that because I do find it, in that word that people use without thinking what it actually means, triggering. In that I can start talking about it, and if I read a news article, or the other day one of my best friends went and retweeted something and said, oh, this is a fantastic article. And it was just full of dog whistle stuff about how trans people are attempting to try and silence lesbians. And it's that.
Stop trying to silence me, Bethany.
I know,
You're so oppressive.
I know.
Go and hang out a toilet or something.
Yeah, yeah,
Jesus.
I know. And check me out. Yeah, like trying to trick lesbians into going out with me and that. Like.
You did show me a card trick and I was taken by it.
I know,
it,
exactly. It was, yeah.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
I often talk to you about things,
yeah,
because I've asked you before, I've been confused by the cisgendered stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's not terminology I grew up using.
No.
So I'm still not entirely sure. Mm-hmm. Trigger warnings are fascinating to,
yeah,
me. Now, we have discussed, being very honest with you, Bethany, mm-hmm, whether or not this podcast needs a trigger warning.
Yeah.
Now, I'm of two minds.
Yeah.
We're talking about mental health and depression. Occasionally we talk about suicide, bit of self-harming, yeah, just the light stuff.
Yeah.
Sometimes if a trigger warning is put on something, it makes it seem like it's going to be more serious than it actually is.
Yeah.
How do you feel about trigger warnings?
Do you know what? I'm not a massive fan of... I mean, it's difficult because...
Sorry, before we go any further, let's explain what they are to an audience, yeah, that might not know. Trigger warnings are... I'm asking you to explain because I still don't understand. I ask you to explain everything, Bethany.
It's easier to kind of explain what they're not, because they are not what people think of. Or trigger warnings. Or what trying to protect people, trying to make people like stop being so sensitive about things. It's not about that. It's for someone like me who has PTSD. What happens is if I have something that triggers me, what happens is that I get a trauma response, is that I completely relive the moment that I was in previously. And one of the reasons that I don't always find trigger warnings particularly useful is because they rarely are the thing that you would think. So talking about suicide, yeah, it doesn't make me feel suicidal. Talking about getting beaten up on public transport doesn't make me scared, doesn't freak me out. However, a smell, colour, the sound, just a sound that you can't even describe to someone else, things like that that can just suddenly put you back in that moment. And they can be completely unrelated. They can have nothing to do with it whatsoever. That just, you know, you remember... You see somebody wearing a colour or a pattern that you saw at some other point, and suddenly your heart starts racing. I think, as far as trigger warnings go, there are things that are obvious, because it's to protect people who have already gone through a lot, rather than people don't want to hear about this. We shouldn't. People should have to hear about everything that's gone on. And you're like, No, you don't.
I see, my theory is that if it's a podcast about mental health and depression, they'll probably know that we're talking about mental health and depression.
Yeah.
However...
That's not your fault if they don't.
No.
If they haven't figured that out by the time
so
you get to...
I've had so many arguments with people about apologising for things. I get very angry when you have to apologise for everything.
Yeah.
Like if you say... Hey, guys are great. Oh, and women. Yeah. And everyone else. And I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's why I get tied up in knots, because I sometimes feel terribly guilty. Do you know what it is? This is why people sometimes were afraid to talk about gay people and now trans people.
Yeah.
What do I call you? Is that your wife?
Yeah.
And they get so caught up in terminology.
They do. And they forget.
They're concerned.
Yeah, they do. And they forget to treat people like people.
Yes.
Which is the thing. It goes back to that idea of treating people as thought experiments. You know, when you almost every day in the press, there is something which is anti-trans, and there is something that has people, like the article in The Guardian that was the other day went and ran with, I'm paraphrasing it, but it pretty much said, both trans people and women are victims of male violence. And one of my friends was like, well, how is that offensive? And it's like, oh, well, because it's suggesting, like it's implicitly suggesting that the two groups are mutually exclusive. And
that no matter what happens, you're not a woman.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I can.
No matter what you've been through,
no matter
how many toilets you hang around outside, you're not a woman.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. Because of, you know, someone raised a really good point the other day that I read and went, yeah, this is it. Because I was trans before I came out. I was gay before I came out. I was gay before I realised that I was gay. I was trans before I realised that I was trans. I have always been trans. So I have grown up as a trans girl and then as a trans woman, even though everyone else assumed that I was cisgender male until I was about 18. It doesn't matter what other people have thought of you up until that point. And so that's where that thing comes from. It's like, well, you're not a woman. Well, I am. I'm a trans woman. And if you are a woman and you're not trans, then you're a cis woman. One of my friends gets really annoyed with the term cis because apparently I'm pronouncing it incorrectly, which, because she's a Latin scholar.
Oh, so that's what we've got to get annoyed at now.
Yeah, that's her as a Latin scholar. She's like, it's more pronounced kiss. I was like, kiss.
Oh, come on now, no.
Kiss just gender.
That's too much, Bethany. I can't survive in the new world.
I know, I can't either. That is too much too far. I did a bit in my last show about it, about how it's because we don't use cis as a term, as a prefix for very many things other than cistern. Because all it means is on the same side as. It's, you know, it comes from the Latin, cis and trans, and that is all it is. And people get really...
So I'm a cis woman.
Yeah.
You're a trans woman.
Yeah. Yeah, we are both women.
Let's call the whole thing off.
We could form a Venn diagram of women, which we're both in,
yes.
And then trans women, which
and
I'm
lesbians.
In.
We're both lesbians.
Lesbians, yeah. Yes. We could have a three-way Venn diagram.
We could also do a sitcom called The Two Lesbians. Before we finish off, yeah, Bethany, sure. I always like to leave the last word to whoever it is that I'm talking to.
Yep.
Anything you want. I don't know who's listening to this show.
Okay.
Depressed people, not depressed people, people on the bus. Whatever. Yeah. So, say what you want. This is your last word. What do you want to say? Depression, trans, anything?
The thing that has been difficult for me to recognise is, as I've got older and I've realised quite the length and breadth of my mental health challenges that I have, is to be a lot easier on myself. That is the number one thing that I need to do, is to allow myself to be okay with the fact that there are things that I can't do and there are things that I can do, and there are times when I should push myself and times when I shouldn't push myself, and I won't know when those times are. But whichever I choose, I should be a lot easier on myself, because so much of my day-to-day difficulties come down to me being really disappointed in myself and worrying that everyone else is going to be disappointed in me when they've got their own things to worry about. You know, each day is a new attempt. You've got a whole new horizon of things to disappoint people over. But most people don't care what is actually going on inside your head. And you've just got to, you know, you've got to be able to deal with that. You've got to be able to accept it. Self-acceptance is one of the most important things to be able to get through
the day. Couldn't agree more. Accepting who you are, enjoying who you are, challenging who you are, but ultimately saying, this is it.
Yeah.
This is it.
Yeah, this is it. And it's...
no big deal. This is it. This is what you got.
Yeah. And it's all right. And I'm okay. I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Can't wait till we make the sitcom pilot. Just you and me in a flat that's been repossessed by a landlord because it looks like we've abandoned it because we've been at the fringe. No water, no electricity, but having fun.
It'd be like a lesbian waiting for Godot, wouldn't it?
Exactly like that. I can't see how someone will not buy that, Bethany.
Yeah, I think at Sky Atlantic at the very least.
Oh, Sky Atlantic would love that one. Worst case scenario, Sky Arts.
Yeah, yeah.
It's fine. As long as three people see it, we'll be okay.
I'm happy with that.
Cheers, Beth.
Thank you very much.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe to the podcast wherever you download your podcast from, and then you'll automatically get next week's episode. Next week, I'll be talking to Mark Watson.
For a lot of people, it is as simply as, look at her dancing, she must have a great life. So then what is she complaining about?
It's like the woman who came up to my wife in the toilets of the Stand Comedy Club and went, must be a laugh a minute living with Susan. I've never seen my wife laugh so much.
Yeah, it's amazing. People have said that to me to people around me as well. Yeah. I bet he's fun to live with.
Oh, he must be a great laugh, eh?
No, he definitely is not. Yeah.
If you like the show, do leave us a review, as that'll help other people find it too. And if you want to get in touch, then you can email mrsbrightside@bbc.co.uk. And finally, we know this podcast talks about things that might have affected you or someone you know personally. If that's the case and you'd like some further info, head to the Mrs. Brightside page on the BBC website and we'll put up some links to places you might find useful. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, Calman out.
Hello, my name's Josie Long and I present Shortcuts, which is also made by the BBC and available as a podcast. You strike me as somebody who already knows how to access podcasts. You're not going, what's a podcast? Well, it's like a radio show, but you carry it around on your iPod. What's an iPod? I don't feel like that's you. We would love it if you gave us a try. Short documentaries for radio on a theme. It's like a longer documentary, but better, more time efficient. If that sounds like something you're interested in, please subscribe to Shortcuts, however you normally get your podcasts. We promise you, you will not regret the decision. And if you do, we will probably have no way of knowing that. Our guarantee.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.